Vermont Viewpoint is a public affairs program produced and funded by WDEV and the Radio Vermont Group. We welcome listener feedback. Email your comments to vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com.
Good morning. This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV. I'm Rick Sengary. This is actually an encore edition of Vermont Viewpoint. All week long, we'll be bringing you some of the best of interviews of the past year. Each day this week, we'll focus on a different topic. You'll hear interviews about Vermont-made beers and spirits, and interviews with some of WDEV's all-stars as we continue our 90th anniversary. And since these are recorded interviews, we will not be able to take any calls. Today, we shine the spotlight on four Vermont businesses. Later in the show, you'll hear about Darn Tough Socks, Bergamot and Amore Leather Bags, and Richard Bates, the British clockmaker. But first, we start with what might be the quirkiest and most fun store in all of Vermont, Catland Vintage in Winooski. Let's listen to the interview we had earlier this year with shop owners Jay and Joe McCaskill. Sometimes you don't know what's missing in this world till somebody comes up with the idea for something that we probably should have had all along, like a vintage shop dedicated to cats. Oh, yeah. I'm just glad this stroke of genius struck right here in Vermont, in Winooski. And now to meet the two people who created Catland Vintage. First of all, Jay McCaskill. Jay, welcome to Vermont Viewpoint.
Hi there. Thank you.
You're welcome. And her husband and co-owner, Joe McCaskill. Joe, great to have you here as well.
Hey, nice to be here. Thanks.
You're welcome. Jay, what exactly is Catland Vintage?
Well, Catland Vintage is a eclectic vintage store with a very strong cat theme. We have antique vintage items up to about 1970s. Sometimes things a little more recent sneak in. And a lot of our things have cats on them. We have a lot of cat figurines, cat art, anything that has a cat on it that was made before 1970, we try to get it in the store.
I think eclectic is understood, Jay, but I'm glad you threw that in as the description. Joe, where'd the idea come from for Catland Vintage?
Well, I'm going to have to say that was all Jay.
Mm-hmm.
when I met her, 13 or so years ago, she probably had a smallish, by her standards, collection of, ceramic cats. And, I watched it grow, as did our relationship. And then it just got to be nuts. And then we would go to estate sales, and we would walk out with boxes of stuff. And then it was, not just cat figurines, but cat art and aprons and, anything you can think of. So that's pretty much all Jay's idea.
And Joe, you kept thinking, as this collection grows, our love does grow. So let it happen. buy another box. Joe, to your knowledge, is there any other place on earth like Catland Vintage?
I don't think so. We've tried to find those places. We keep thinking that because our collection is so eclectic and it's, been hand-selected and, for so long, someone's going to come in and just write a check for all of it and take it away. I kind of consider it kind of like the Cooperstown of, antique cats, And, obviously, vintage cats were not in my scene before I met Jay. But, we certainly haven't seen, we'll run across one or two when we're in antique stores or thrift stores, but certainly nothing like this.
All right, Jay, take me through the conversation, whatever conversation the two of you had, when one of the two of you turns to the other and says, I have a great idea. Let's open a shop with all this stuff.
Well, I think like most great ideas, it started as sort of a joke, and it just became... it went from being a joke to becoming a goal. And we were in California and knew we wouldn't be living there for the rest of our lives and trying to figure out, well, what do we do with ourselves? And we had started to amass a pretty big hoard of stuff, not just cat stuff, but just vintage items in general, We really like kitsch stuff. We're into movies, old music. And so the joke eventually evolved into an imperative. I mean, when you end up with so much stuff, you either have to open a shop or create a very bad situation for someone else to clean up when you pass on. So we decided that, you know, we can't take it with us later in our lives. So it's better to be able to send these little kitties and other cool items back into the world and get to enjoy seeing these items have a new life.
That's beautiful. Joe, give us a little give us a little tour around Catland.
Oh, geez. Okay. Well, yeah.
And you can get help.
It's on Little because it is a tiny shop.
That's right. And you can get help from Jay as you need it. But I'm putting you in charge of the tour so far.
Yeah. You know, you walk into the brightly colored yellow space on the outside. You turn to the left, and there's some cats. There's a whole bunch of ceramic cats. And then a lot of real eclectic art, not all of it's cats, just a lot of stuff from the 50s and 60s. A lot of, you know, black velvet paintings we ended up with. You can't say no to those when they're $10 at an estate sale.
Right.
You know, you gotta rescue that stuff. We were like 10% dog items.
Wow.
Canine
ears just perked up all across the state.
It's like having, you know, a barbecue place that has some vegetarian items.
Yep.
You know,
right.
You got to appease that small group that says, what about me?
You got it.
So if dog people come in and say, what about us? We point to the 6 or 7 dog items and say, there you go.
There's our dog section over there in that corner. Yeah, back, that's it.
Right. Yeah, it's behind a curtain, so, you know.
That's right.
They can't be shamed. We don't want any fight between dog and cat people. We don't need that.
And we also have records, used records, and vintage cookbooks, and we're trying to really focus on Vermont vintage cookbooks. So we really appreciate the regional history. Anything old Vermont as well, we definitely hope that we can increase the volume of that stuff.
Well, that's fantastic. I know there's a big, beautiful tiger velvet painting there at the store. I think there's panthers. So it's not just kitty cats. It's a lot of feline stuff. And Jay, the non-cat stuff, non-dog stuff, is there stuff that's just neither fish nor fowl, neither cat nor dog?
Absolutely. We have a small section of vintage clothes. We have sheet music, antique sheet music, which I love just because of the cover art. And a lot of those pieces go back to the early 1900s. We have a lot of homewares, dishes, plant pots, all the things that I love to collect, and I know that other people love too. We've got it. So definitely you can take your non-animal loving friends to the store and they will find something that suits their taste as well.
All right. So if they start to kick up a little fuss and say, I don't want to go to a cat store, you'll find something here.
All right. And to be honest, our cat stuff is it's hard to replace. So we're a little protective of it. We're obviously selling a lot of cat stuff, but being that's our theme, it's kind of a relief when people buy other stuff so that we don't have to start going out and scouring the world for new vintage cat stuff to replace the old cat stuff.
Do you have a daily limit? Like if you sell 5 cat things, do you cut people off? Sorry, folks.
We are afraid that, you know, someday someone like me is going to walk in the store and, as Joe said, just buy everything. Although that might be an easy out for us, so I guess that wouldn't be the worst thing that happens.
The person who walks in next says, I thought you had stuff. We just sold it all. Sorry.
It just left with
that guy. You might be able to buy a cat from him. Joe, how much love do you have for cats, Joe?
Well, you know, not as much as Jay, but having cats of our own, I certainly have grown to appreciate them. I think maybe I had one cat, you know, before I met Jay. I mean, I was, you know, not at that time. No, it's the thing about it for me is that it really is fantastic, you know, art and a great representative of, you know, mid-century modern stuff. So, I mean, they're really all beautiful. So that aspect for me is, you know, fun to collect. But, you know, it's Jay's the one who's getting them from the store. You know, I see Chuff and say, okay, this is something she would like. Or this fits. Because, you know, it's kind of a narrow spectrum of what would fit in our store. I mean, we certainly don't just grab any ceramic cat and say, okay, you're with the rest of the cat family here. I mean, it's got to have a specific look and date and things like that.
So curating.
Thank you. I guess I could have just curated and
to make sure they have all their shots and all that kind of stuff, too. So. This is an encore edition of Vermont Viewpoint, which means we're unable to take calls this morning. Let's take a break and then return to hearing all about Winooski's Catland Vintage. This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV.
Warren Village is a picture-perfect snow globe this time of year. We invite you to visit us at the almost world-famous Warren store. Come for breakfast, lunch, or après-ski. Have a signature deli sandwich, a hearty soup, or a specialty coffee drink paired with a sweet treat from our incredible bakery. Upstairs is a cornucopia of delightful and unique finds from men's, women's, and children's clothing to gifts, toys, games, jewelry, hats, gloves, and scarves. Best one-stop shopping in Vermont, according to Yankee Magazine. Fun, funky, safe, and friendly. Warren Store, Main Street, Warren Village, and warrenstore.com.
We're back on Vermont Viewpoint, and we're listening to an entertaining interview from August with Joe and Jay McCaskill, owners of Catland Vintage in Winooski, on this encore version of Vermont Viewpoint. Jay, is there a favorite cat that you have had or that really stands out for you that maybe even inspired all this cat vintage love?
Well, I've had cats my whole life. My parents were big cat people, and so I just have grown up with cats. So in my sort of mentally aware lifetime, I had a couple cats named Summer and Bunter when I was 4 or 5, I think, and they were with me into my teenage years. So they were my formative cats. And fortunately, I've only had a few since then, because if you are a successful cat owner or steward or whatever you want to call mom, cat mom, if you're a successful cat mom, you don't end up having too many cats in your lifetime. They stick around.
Yep. That's a good point. Joe, this is a tricky question. Are cats allowed in Catland Vintage?
They absolutely are.
Aww.
But all we've had is dogs.
Really?
They brought their dogs. Yeah, cats are totally welcome. You know, it's funny. You don't really know what to expect when you open up a Catland type place. But, yeah, people are always, they might not bring in their cats, but, you know, tons of people have said, oh, here's a photo of my cat, and here's this and that. We get cat stories, you know, people, you know, pictures of their cats. It's actually really funny, and it's certainly a great, great way to meet people. But nobody's brought in their cat, but absolutely, that would be nice.
Bring it on.
I love that Joe described Catland Vintage as a Catland type place.
It's like Dolly World, but with cats.
That's right. All right. So, Jay, how did you pick Winooski, Vermont for the Catland Vintage World Headquarters?
Well, we were lucky. It sort of picked us. We were planning to open the store at some point, but we arrived during COVID, and so the plans were kind of on hold. And one day we just realized that this great space in Winooski was available, the old Onion River Cobbler place on West Canal Street. And I love historic buildings, and this storefront is just so authentically early 1900s, and the interior also has most of its original features. It's really like walking back in time. We had to help make some of that happen by peeling off layers of wood paneling that had been put on in a later era. But, I mean, what better place for an antique vintage store than a historic building?
Yeah, so absolutely.
We just jumped at that opportunity. And Winooski is such a vibrant and interesting place, and it was just a window of opportunity that we might not have had otherwise if the world hadn't been on pause last fall.
And it is just off the traffic circle or the Winooski Speedway down West Canal.
We're just learning how people feel about that.
That's right. It is a beautiful old building. Joe, what has been the reaction of people who have visited Catland Vintage so far?
I think they're pretty blown away. Well, I mean, there's two different reactions. One, people really appreciate that something like this exists.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I think you see people with a lot of self-control and, you know, maybe they'll buy one or two items, but, you know, they could walk out with 20. So I think people really appreciate just the fact that a store like that exists. And then secondly, for the non-cat people, we have enough, you know, musical instruments and art and other stuff that, you know, I think they appreciate that as well. You know, there's not another antique store around there. So the reaction has been great. And it's funny, you know, we're from San Diego, so we got here a year ago. And you really don't realize how nice mm-hmm. Vermonters are until you have a store and see people all day.
Yep.
And every single person, you know, we're having these long conversations with people we would never meet. Yep. But they're just happy a space like that exists, and we're happy that people like that are coming in.
I love it.
You know, it's been a real bonus for the whole, you know, the whole thing.
Well, Joe mentioned musical instruments, so I have to ask, what is Pony Death Ride?
Well, Pony Death Ride is our not-so-secret musical comedy alter ego. Joe and I are longtime rock musicians, and when we met, as Joe said, about 13 years ago, we were getting a little bit tired of the rock and roll music grind. We were both in different bands, and that's how we came to meet. And we just realized that a lot of the instruments were very heavy, the equipment, it was a bit of a pain to schlep all that stuff around. So we said, hey, why don't we just strip it all down to a ukulele and a tambourine, maybe the occasional kazoo, and play some music and have a good time. And so we are a little blue, not too bad, but we're definitely parental guidance recommended.
Gotcha.
And we've sort of forgotten how to play our songs over the past year, but we're hoping that now that we've got the store finished, that we can gradually get back into playing music again.
All right. You have to let us know when that's happening. Joe, we talked about the building, how beautiful it is, and the work that needed to be done to it. The exterior of the building is painted canary yellow. The interior walls are robin's egg blue. Is this a nod to cats?
Well, no. But because it sounds so good, I'm going to say, yeah. That's
there you go.
What we had in mind. You know, being tucked in the corner right there next to Rosie's Confections, you know, we were, because we're on the end of the circle there, Jay's brilliant idea was, well, how can we, you know, attract people down here? And so yellow was the answer. And even the building owner was like, what are you talking, a yellow building? and we've had so many people come in and say, wow, that's what a good idea.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and Jay reminds me every time that was her idea. but the blue inside was actually a color we found as we were stripping down just all that excess wood that was in there. And, you know, we have photos on our website of this project and how much wood there was. And it was just nuts. But when we finally got down underneath everything, we found that color in some spots. And so we matched that. It just so happened it looks really good in there. That's a great color. But it was probably from the 50s or so.
Yeah. 40s, 50s.
So we wanted to kind of honor the the legacy of that space.
Mm. The Star Bakery era.
Yeah. Oh, wow. Hey, Jay, where can I get some wearable cat heads?
Well, we do have a few that are potentially for sale in the store. They make great decor, but if someone wants to buy a big plush cat head, we can probably accommodate them. The cat heads that we had were purchased for a music video that we made probably 10 years ago. And of the dozen or so costumes that we had to buy for this big video project, we managed to get rid of everything but the cat head. We figured they'd come in handy one day.
So this is kind of like a vintage store / museum, isn't it, over there at Catland?
A little bit. I actually have an educational and professional background in museums, truth be told.
There we go. Joe, if you weren't running such a brilliant little shop, what would you be doing?
Probably running a dog-themed vintage store. The answer is, who knows? Nothing. I mean, I really have no talent. I mean, I was a teacher for a while. I was a terrible real estate agent in California for a couple years. I mean, this is like, I needed this store. You know, I needed to say, yeah, oh, this is what I do. I'm a business owner. Truth is, making pizzas or I don't know.
Yeah.
I'm just happy to be in from
keeps Joe McCaskill off the streets. There we go.
That's pretty much it.
Oh, my. Jay and Joe McCaskill are stirring it up in the news. Their shop is called Catland Vintage. You can learn more at the website, catlandvintage.com. Jay and Joe, this has been like a catnip treat. Thank you so much for being on the show this morning.
Oh, we appreciate it. Yes. Thank you so much.
All right. Take care.
That was a recorded interview from earlier this year with Jay and Joe McCaskill, owners of Catland Vintage in Winooski. We'll take a break, and then we'll hear from Rick Cabot of Darn Tough Socks. This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV. We're back on this best of edition of Vermont Viewpoint. We're focused on Vermont businesses this morning, and next we listen back to our conversation in October with Darn Tough Vermont CEO Rick Cabot. And please keep in mind, there are no phone calls during this week.
I can honestly say I never gave a whole lot of thought to my socks until I moved to Vermont, unless you count that brief fling with toe socks back in the 80s. What changed it for me has been Cabot Hosiery Mill in Northfield and then their Darn Tough Socks. I was a morning show DJ in Montpelier, just starting to do some running when Rick Cabot sent some prototypes of Darn Tough Socks for me to try while I ran. My feet have been so happy from that point on. Now, almost two decades later, the world knows about and sings the praises of Darn Tough, and well, they should. Joining me now to talk about the socks and the latest company developments is Darn Tough Vermont CEO Rick Cabot. Rick, great to have you.
Good morning, Rick. It's great to hear your voice, and I appreciate the nice introduction. And yes, those are fond memories. Back in the early days of 03 and 04 of Darn Tough, it was tough, but you know, we made it through, and I think you and I had a lot of fun.
Yeah, we did. As a matter of fact, I have not worn out those prototypes. I have a pair with me this morning. They even have the old logo of the somebody hammering on a sock on a anvil on the sock itself. So they did not ever wear out. Rick, when did your family get into the sock business?
I'm technically the third generation of my family in the sock business. So my father started Cabot Hosiery in Northfield with a partner in 1978. And then prior to that, my father and his father, my grandfather, were in the sock business, I believe in New England and then in the Carolinas, because a lot of that production went down to the Carolinas. It's a family thing at its roots. I got involved in 1989, a couple of years after graduating University of Colorado Buffalo, go Buffs. And then I bought my father's, he had a partner at the time, I bought his partner out. And, the rest is sort of a slow simmering history.
And how did Northfield become the base for Cabot Hosiery?
Well, my father was repping a mill that was in Northfield. So I think when that mill closed its doors, it was a smaller mill. There was, you know, there was labor there. There was machinery there. We still have some folks, although that number gets fewer and fewer every year. We still have some folks that were there in 78.
Wow.
That still work today. So, yeah, it was a, there was still an semblance back in the 70s of a textile industry or a textile business in New England. You know, years ago, everything was done here. We had, there were shoe factories here, there were sweater mills here, there were yarn mills here. So, it, you know, through attrition, everything, as it always does, changes. But there was some, you know, there was a small presence here, and that's how it ended up being in Northfield.
And what kind of socks were you making back then prior to Darn Toughs?
Prior to Darn Tough, it's what we call private label in the industry. So if we're making socks for a brand, another brand, or a department store, you know, we would make it for them mm-hmm. and put their label on it. You know, private labeling obviously still goes on. Most people don't manufacture what they sell. So if you go into a store and it says, you know, XYZ department store, or XYZ brand, that's a private label brand that somebody else made for that store or brand. And then we would put somebody else's name on it. And that was good for a while. And then all of a sudden the offshoring happened. And that was, you know, there aren't enough hours in the day to talk about offshoring. But,
well, let's talk about it just for a little bit, though, because there was a point,
okay,
Rick.
Okay.
You did have to decide whether to move production overseas or to stay in Vermont. And you decided to stay here. So what, you know, just briefly, what did go into making that decision to stay in Northfield?
I guess we had the ability to do it. So again, we had experienced people, we had machinery, we had three generations of sock know-how, and we put that legacy into making our own brand. I was confident that we could do it better than anybody else because we had that rich legacy. And we, you know, we weren't after the cheapest product. We were after the best product.
Mm-hmm.
So we had the experience, and I say we had the legacy to produce the best socks. And, you know, that pair that you have that has no holes in it, you know, it's a testament to everybody coming together in Northfield and now in Waterbury to, you know, produce best in class.
Well, that was the development of Darn Tough Socks. So what went into that idea, you know, and when did you come up with, you know, we've got this technology, we can make this kind of sock, and then how did it get, you know, launched?
We were really almost out of business. Like I said, we were producing private label product for a lot of different companies and brands. There wasn't a lot of money to be made there. There wasn't a lot of profit to be made there. And I didn't want to see the ship go down. So it was sort of a, you know, a Hail Mary. We have to do something. We have to solve a problem. We have to be profitable. And, you know, the problem was that there really wasn't a good high-end performance sock for the outdoor industry back in 2003 and 2004. It was crowded in the middle, but there was nobody producing, you know, sort of that pinnacle best-in-class product. And that's how it started. You know, it was an attempt to save a legacy and remain made in Vermont. And the timing was right. The messaging was right.
Mm-hmm.
People liked it. loved it, and we grew, you know, steadily, slowly, you know, pair after pair, week after week, month after month.
Yeah, and that Hail Mary pass was caught in the end zone for a touchdown because Darn Tough is so vibrant now, so well known. And how has the product line expanded from when you first introduced them back in 03, 04?
It sort of has expanded, and I'm happy to say that on some level it hasn't expanded. You know, the roots of the product still merino wool. And we knit with nylon, and we knit with lycra. So there's three ingredients in our socks, and those three ingredients have remained constant. Now, what we've done to remain relevant to our customers is, you know, expand the line greatly. So we started out with a running sock. We then got into hiking socks. We got into ski socks, kids socks, lifestyle, work. We have contracts for the military, so our product team in Northfield does a fantastic job of coming up with with new, fun, relevant styles, and everything still has our unconditional lifetime guarantee. If you wear our socks, replace them. So at the core, it's the same, but we've expanded that core into different categories. They like what we stand for, and, you know, we just keep satisfying the needs of our customers.
Where are Darn Tough socks sold now throughout the world?
They're sold all over the world. I'm not exactly sure how many countries outside the United States, but it may be over 11. I know we do a lot of business in Canada. We do a lot of business in Western Europe, Japan. We're getting into South America. So it's a nice steady growth.
And I got to ask, you know, with the guarantee, about how many socks do you get, you know, in the course of say a month or a year to be replaced?
I would say just the right amount.
It is an unbelievable guarantee. Yeah. And I'm still trying to wear out a Darn Tough sock.
We're listening to an interview with Rick Cabot of Darn Tough Vermont, recorded earlier this year. We'll be back after this break to hear more about what's happening at Darn Tough. This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV.
Warren Village is a picture-perfect snow globe this time of year. We invite you to visit us at the almost world-famous Warren store. Come for breakfast, lunch, or après-ski. Have a signature deli sandwich, a hearty soup, or a specialty coffee drink paired with a sweet treat from our incredible bakery. Upstairs is a cornucopia of delightful and unique finds from men's, women's, and children's clothing to gifts, toys, games, jewelry, hats, gloves, and scarves. Best one-stop shopping in Vermont, according to Yankee Magazine. Fun, funky, safe, and friendly. Warren Store, Main Street, Warren Village, and warrenstore.com.
Welcome back to Vermont Viewpoint. I'm Rick Zingari. We're listening to our best interviews of the past year this week. Today we're focused on Vermont businesses. Right now, you're hearing our interview with Rick Cabot, CEO of Darn Tough Vermont.
Rick, when did you know that Darn Toughs were becoming the flagship brand for your company?
When did I know?
An exact day and time would be really great.
Yeah, I'm going through the calendar.
Here it is.
That's a hard question to answer because, you know, it's happened over time.
Mm-hmm.
Certainly we weren't, an overnight success. I think it's tough to be an overnight success because, you know, you can sort of lose it that quickly also.
Yeah.
So, you know, I would say as the years went on from 05 to 07, we got some military contracts for the Air Force, for the Army, the Marines. They recognized the quality of our socks. So, you know, every year it's sort of gone a little bit further. Our ability to satisfy our customer has gotten a little bit better. And, you know, we're still doing that today. We don't rest on, where we've been or where we are. It's very important to us, where we're going.
At this point, do you produce any other socks other than Darn Toughs, or are you completely Darn Tough now?
We're 99% Darn Tough. We do still have a little bit of private label, business that we take care of, but, you know, 99%. percent of the production is for Darn Tough.
All right, we've got Mary joining us from Randolph. Hi, Mary. Go right ahead.
Hi. Good morning. Good morning.
Good morning.
I love Darn Tough socks. Love buying them for the family too. They make great gifts,
yes,
long-term
they do.
Gifts. but I'm wondering if you've ever thought, because the Red Sox are in the news, love the Red Sox. Have you ever thought of making Red Sox?
Oh, you know, Mary, that's an interesting question. I will tell you that because of the Red Sox, when I was a kid, my mom will tell you, would have told you, I only wore Red Sox. It drove her a little nuts. But Rick, a Red Sox Darn Tough sock?
Well, we're waiting for the Red Sox to give us a call. I think if the timing were right, you know, it's something we could look into.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we do. I think we have a few socks with a little bit of red in them. I don't know if that would satisfy you, but we're open to at least all possibilities.
You know? All right, Steven's joining us from Montpelier. Hi, Steven.
Yeah, Rick. I just was wondering how many socks Darn Tough makes in a year.
Yeah, we make more socks than you can shake a stick at, and it's a lot. I hate to get into specifics about pairs, but it's well into the millions of pairs. Millions.
Wow. Rick, do you know, we all have the problem when we do our laundry, we wind up with, you know, that stray sock, that unpaired sock. Does that happen at the mill quite at all? I mean, I guess it would just have to be at the end of production, you have one extra sock because you can pair two socks very easily there, I'm imagining.
Well, for some reason, we lose T-shirts and underwear, and I can't explain that, even though we don't have anything to do with that. But every now and then, you know, there's a T-shirt missing. We try not to lose socks. There are socks, you know, everywhere. Yeah, I think if you see one, there's probably the mate to that sock around someplace. But, yeah, that's one of those old stories that just keeps getting passed on.
Mm-hmm. Now, one of the great institutions in the state is the Cabot Sock Sale. When did that get started?
That started in, I would say, maybe 79 or 80. Again, our roots in Northfield go to 78. But I would say maybe 78, 79. Mm-hmm. I'm not exactly sure. And then we had it consistently every year since then, but with COVID in 20 and 21, you know, it's a risk that you know, we don't want to put people into.
Yeah.
And I'm thinking that people don't want to be surrounded by hundreds of people within less than an arm's distance.
Absolutely. Now, during that sale, I will say we get to meet many of the people who work at Darn Tough. And I know it's got to be a busy couple of weeks when you put it on, but they treat everyone so well, seem to be so proud to have people come and see where they work. Is that the vibe you get from your staff there?
That's you know, I'm happy that you mentioned that. Vermont is a small state, sort of a community within itself, and Northfield is a small town, and Waterbury is a small town. So a lot of people that come in are folks' neighbors, and we treat everybody that way. We're grateful for the business, and you know, we like having folks come in and see what we're doing. Hopefully, within the next couple of years anyway, we'll be able to revive the sock sale.
Yeah. Now,
we're very much a family business.
Yeah, and it shows on those days in particular. So. And I get to, you know, I'd meet your father there every year and chat about socks. It was a great time. You did purchase the building in Waterbury, I think it was about a year and a half ago, and finally open now. Tell us about the new building.
For the record, we didn't purchase it. We're leasing space with a few other businesses, and we have – oh, I would say close to 100, maybe 120,000 square feet. We have offices there, marketing is there, sales is there, some operation folks are there, customer service is there. So we have a lot of offices. And we also have about, I think, maybe 40,000 square feet devoted to machinery. We just got 48 new machines up and running, and we're making socks there 24 hours a day, 5 days a week right now. And we have another 48 or so machines coming in by the end of the year to support our growth. So it's quite the transformation, you know, from a place that produced coffee and now a place that produces socks. But the space is great, and it's right off the interstate, and we're hiring. Waterbury has been terrific for us.
And this, you said, use the word growth. So this has added jobs to Darn Tough? It's not just moving jobs from Northfield to Waterbury?
No, there's a few people who would rather work in Waterbury because of where they live. But no, these are new jobs. We're close to 400 people right now.
Wow.
In both locations, in both sort of office folks and manufacturing folks. In 2003 or 4, when we started this, we had 35 people.
Unbelievable.
So, it's a testament to a good idea. It's a testament to hard work, and our employees, they get it done. They make it happen every single day, and you know, without them, without all of us, you know, it would just never happen. Ideas are good, but you have to put something behind it. You got to put people behind it in order to really move it forward.
Rick, what is the best part of being in the sock business?
I think the best part about being in the sock business is not being in any other business. It's great to focus. You know, we don't make t-shirts. We don't make base layers. We don't make gloves. We don't make hats. You know, it's that focus of this is what we do. This is all we do. And we come to work doing that every single day. And we do that, in my opinion, and hopefully our customers' opinion, better than anybody else. It's a lot of product. There's a lot of design and fun challenges involved in it. You know, focus, focus, focus. That's what we do.
Still having fun?
Yeah, the fun is, the fun is changed. It's evolved. But, yeah, it's exciting, you know, to see a Kona yarn, and then you put machinery and people to it, and you get a 3D product that you can put on.
Yeah.
It's a fascinating little process.
Rick Cabot is CEO of Darn Tough Vermont. You can learn more about what's going on at Darn Tough by visiting darntough.com. Rick, always great to hang out with another Rick who spells his name without a K. Thanks so much for being on with us this morning.
Thank you, Rick.
That was Rick Cabot of Darn Tough Vermont when we spoke with him in October. All this week, we're playing back the best of Vermont Viewpoint. After we break for CBS News to get an update, we'll return to hear from the owners of Bergamot Namur in Williamstown. This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV. We're back on Vermont Viewpoint. It's a special week of our best interviews from 2021. Next up, we head to Billtown to hear from the co-owners of Bergamot and Amore, Amanda Marie Farrell and Peter Shangra. This is an encore edition of the show, so we're unable to take any calls. Sorry, Fred.
Nothing makes me happier than to be chatting with friends and I'm able to tell them about things in Vermont that they've never heard of, like the rodeo at the Pond Hill Ranch in Castleton that's been going on now for 50 years. When I mention it, even people who live here in Vermont for their whole lives, their eyes kind of bug out. What? But even better is when they surprise me with a place, an event, or a company in Vermont that I've never heard of and that I really need to know about, and then I can let you know all about it. That happened last week when I was talking about my man purse, or MERS, and my friend said, "Do you know Bergamot Namur?" At first, I thought she was speaking in tongues, and then she showed me who they are and what they do. It's incredible stuff. They're right here in Williamstown. I was stunned. And then, of course, at my earliest possible convenience, I reached out to get them on the show so that you all know about what's happening down there in Billtown. Here to share their story is Bergamot and Amour co-owner Amanda Marie Farrell. Amanda, welcome to Vermont Viewpoint.
Hey, Rick. Thanks for having us.
Oh,
I'm here
so
with
great.
Peter.
Oh, Peter is there. Okay, Peter Shangra, the other co-owner. Peter, welcome to you as well.
Hi, Rick. Thanks for having us.
So glad to have you. Glad you could both make it. All right. What is Bergamot and Amour?
Well, we are a leather goods company that just popped up by accident. We are located here in Williamstown, Vermont, and we specialize or are well known for our handbags.
Where'd the name come from, Bergamot and Amour?
So Bergamot and Amour, we named primarily because of my favorite native pollinator plant, bee balm. And Amour is a family name of Peter's.
It's beautiful. There are two of you in the business, so give us some idea of the backgrounds of each of you. And Peter, you're going to have to speak up now, but we'll let Amanda go first. Amanda, tell us about your background.
Sure. So I have a background in fine art and some marketing. And prior to this company, I was doing some watercolor painting just as commission-based projects. Mm-hmm. And, yeah.
Peter?
Here's-
so I lived in Williamstown my whole life. I have had a small upholstery shop here. It was Shangri-La Upholstery, and just been working on cars and boats for the last 10-plus years. And I commissioned Amanda to do some painting for me, and that's how we met. And then we just started talking about projects and ended up making a bag, and it kind of just blossomed.
I love the fact that at one time you were actually competitors, correct?
Yeah. So I owned a small company called Vermont Reupholstery. It was a one-man show or one-woman show. And I did home upholstery. So I was renovating people's sofas, couches, things like that, based out of Burlington. And Peter kind of handled the central Vermont area, and I did the Burlington and northern places.
And then this idea for Bergamot and Amour, how'd that all come about?
So Peter hired me to do some paintings for him. I actually painted a mural here at his house last summer. And then right after Thanksgiving, we started having coffee. I was doing a lot of smaller watercolor projects for him, and we decided to just start having coffee and talk about art. Pizza morning person, so I was getting up at 4 o'clock in the morning to have coffee with him in his shop. And we started talking about how we used to be competitors. We both really wanted to work with leather, but hadn't spent a lot of time doing it. It required some new equipment. It was right around the time that we had just received stimulus money from the government, and we both didn't truly need the money, so we invested that into materials and equipment and just made a handbag.
Wow. And then eventually launched the business. Was there any reservation of launching during a pandemic?
So I'll let Pete handle this.
Okay.
It happened really quickly. We went from making one bag and posting it on her Facebook page, just like, hey, look what we did. And a lot of people reached out, how do we get one? Where do we order one? And it wasn't like really much hesitation. We knew that we could make a good quality product, and it looked like there was a market for it. So we kind of just jumped in both feet first, and I've weaned off from the upholstery and gotten just about all the projects finished up with that, and have just solely focused on this. Originally, it was a bag business, and we've branched out. We make wallets, We're going to eventually make backpacks,
leather aprons,
and a few other products as well.
You have the beautiful blanket.
Yeah,
we do have a really nice blanket and dog coats for the winter season here in Vermont. So we've got a lot. Everything that we've been making as we design and release it, we actually patent. So it goes through the USPTO process prior to us releasing, which is why we're a little slow to get things out.
Mm-hmm.
But we're a little methodical and try and move slowly so we can cross all of our T's and dot our I's.
Describe the space where the bags and the gear is made.
Sure. So this often catches people by surprise. We are working out of a very small garage at the base of Peter's driveway. We share the garage with an old Cadillac Coupe de Ville, so we're really truly working in half of the garage. So we have a tight little space, and we're making a lot of leather products right here, just the two of us. So we have shipped over 1,000 bags at this point. We're in 30 different states roughly and 3 countries out of a 2-car garage.
Wow. And when was the official start of the business?
So it was kind of our little project. Up until right around New Year's, we started to really hone in. I can't truly remember the exact date, but it's been a whirlwind. It was right around the first of the year.
So in just over 6 months, you've sold over 1,000 bags, which is really incredible. Talk about how you split the responsibilities of the business. Who does what there?
Sure. So our roles we've tried to remain fluid, and things change every day. So at the moment, Peter is doing all of the sewing and most of the riveting, and we both cut the leather. All of our products are cut by hand. We don't use like a rotary cutter or anything like that. So we're using good old-fashioned scissors, and we're cutting everything by hand, and everything goes through the machine. Peter's hand sewing, and then we are hand riveting. And then I handle a lot of the Facebook marketing e-commerce side of things. So the website, all of the Facebook, if someone reaches out through email, they're likely talking to me unless I'm out or not feeling well. But that hasn't happened yet, so knock on wood. But it's just the two of us kind of juggling.
You've sold 1,000 pieces so far. I'm still stunned. When you decided, okay, this is a thing, we're going to launch this, did you have like a business plan? Did you have a projection of how many pieces you'd think you'd sell in the first year or the first 6 months?
So Peter and I asked and laugh about this.
the first week, we had a friend come over, and he's like, wow, these are awesome. How many do you guys think you're going to sell? And Amanda's like, well, if we sell one in a week, that would be okay. And I was like, if we sell 3 in a week, that's like one every other day. That's a pretty good, you know, thing. And we sold 7 like within the first hour or two, and then it just snowballed.
Have you been able to keep up production wise with just the two of you?
No.
Peter and I are both kind of workaholics, so we're working close to 19-hour long days, 7 days a week, and we have a wait list of about 4 weeks. So when an order comes in, it takes roughly 3 to 4 of us. We offer personalization, so we work with this incredible little company as well here in Barrie called Southpaw Imaging. It's also a 2-man operation, and they do our laser etching for us. So we can do custom leather name tags on the interiors of the bags, and just little personal touches. So we partnered with them on our custom projects. That's why we've got the lead time we do. We work with some really cool people here in town. And
Well, what I like to say is, you know, the only thing worse than being too busy is the reverse of that. And so this is great news that you are so busy right now in a brand new launched business.
Let's take a break and then return to our interview from July with the owners of Bergamot and Amour in Williamstown. This is an encore edition of Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV.
Warren Village is a picture-perfect snow globe this time of year. We invite you to visit us at the almost world-famous Warren store. Come for breakfast, lunch, or après-ski. Have a signature deli sandwich, a hearty soup, or a specialty coffee drink paired with a sweet treat from our incredible bakery. Upstairs is a cornucopia of delightful and unique finds from men's, women's, and children's clothing to gifts, toys, games, jewelry, hats, gloves, and scarves. Best one-stop shopping in Vermont, according to Yankee Magazine. Fun, funky, safe, and friendly. Warren Store, Main Street, Warren Village, and warrenstore.com.
This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV. Our visit to special Vermont businesses took us to Williamstown in July to Bergamot and Amour. Let's continue with this best of interview with co-owners Amanda Marie Farrell and Peter Shangra.
What is the most popular item that Bergamot and Amour has made so far?
Sure. So the most popular item is definitely our Woodstock bag. It's a tote bag. It's the original. So it is our very first design that was ever released. I say that like it's been forever since we've been making them. But it is the, hands down, the most popular bag that we make.
And the colors that you have of the leatherwork are just beautiful.
Thanks.
Yeah, who and how do you come up with those beautiful hues?
Sure. So we work only with U.S. leather. So with the exception of one leather that we have hand-dyed for us, and it's actually imported. But everything else we use comes from United States cows, and it's all cows that would otherwise be buried in the ground. So it's hides that are coming off of cows that are used for other products, beef, dairy, or that have passed away from natural causes.
Wow.
And so the – and that was really important for Peter and I was to use – leather that we felt ethical about. We definitely don't want to be using anything that's coming from like a dairy farm or a farm that's factory farming cows for hides and things like that. So we were very choosy with where we got our leather. 90% of what we use is actually coming from Maine. And the colors we're hand selecting, kind of on, we have our staple colors and then we make limited batch runs, for open houses, personal shoppers that can do in-person events and when we take things on the road. So we've always got a little something special tucked up our sleeves. On occasion we do some fun social posts where people can get their hands on something where we've only made like four of, so we try and keep it really personal and sweet.
Wow. Is there a retail presence or has everything been done online so far?
So everything that we do is consumer direct. We are not wholesaling. We don't have a retail presence. It's all e-commerce. We have done two open shops now where, unfortunately, due to our limited space, we can't have folks swing in at their convenience because it's so tight in here and we use some sharp equipment to cut through the leather and things like that. But we try to at least monthly or every other month deep clean the shop, pull the caddy out, and make space for people to come in and try on bags, which has been very, very fun and very successful. The last two that we've had, we actually sold completely out of inventory during our shops.
Wow. I wondered if the Cadillac had to go when you had an open shop.
I know. It's bittersweet. We pull her out just for the few hours that we're open. But
now, the two of you did something pretty special for a family who really needed some support. Tell us about that.
Sure. So Peter and I, a big motivator for us is to give back to the community. We've been in positions where people have helped us in the past. And so, by nature, we saw, a our photographer, actually, it's a family member of hers. She had shared a really touching story. And a young girl who was 8 had a brain aneurysm. My father actually passed away from a brain aneurysm when I was a kiddo. So I felt like we just needed to do something. So Peter and I quickly scrambled to post something on social. And we announced that we would donate all sales profits for the week to the family of this little girl to help cover medical costs. Both of the parents were self-employed, so we know what it's like to have a kiddo in the hospital and you kind of have to give up everything to be there for them. So we wanted to make sure that we could do whatever we could to help support them. And we were able to donate $10,000. Oh. So the community really showed up, and they showed up in a really big way.
What a beautiful story. You mentioned the photographer. The photography on your website and social media is stunning. Tell us about the photographer and whoever's Olds Cutlass and John Deere tractor that is that, are front and center in a lot of those beautiful photos.
I love it. So our photographer is Justin Orman. She owns JVO Photography. She is amazing. Jess is a total delight. She is actually a school teacher full time. So this photography gig of hers is something she does on the side for fun. She bought one of our bags very early on and snapped a couple photos of the one that she purchased. And immediately we knew we needed her. So we reached out and we covet her and hold on to her very tightly. She does a lot of our photography. And really, really helps us. So if you can or need a photographer, you should definitely reach out to Jess. She's really, really amazing.
Now, we've only talked about a few of the items you make, so I think it's time you tell us about the different products that you're making there at Bergamot and Amour.
Yeah. So Peter and I, we make the Woodstock, which is our tote bag. We have the Stratton book bag, which is a smaller little bag. It's kind of a little satchel with a flap. We have the Biltown Bifold, which is our new men's wallet, which is coming out on Friday.
Oh.
We also have, being released on Friday, the Woodstock Mini. So we have had lots and lots of asks for a smaller version of the classic Woodstock. And so we are releasing that to the public on Friday, and it's a third less of the original size. So it's this adorable little tote bag. And then beyond that, we have our Mansfield blanket, which is a weather-resistant picnic blanket, or it could be used as a shelter or anything, really. It's made with a 20-ounce wax canvas, and on the interior, or the flip side of it, it is Johnson wool. So we're using Vermont product and trying to help out our local farmers and our local businesses here. So that's another product. And we have the Cabot Clutch, which is named after a woman in Cabot who really needed a wallet, and we made it for her and then just kind of rolled it out for everyone else.
Oh, that's fantastic. I understand, speaking of local businesses, they really love you over at the Graniteville Post Office.
Oh, yeah. So we are indebted to them for our forever. They're incredible. They've been so tolerant with us. We bring all of our – I package all of our boxes up here in the shop, Pete and I. That's typically how we'll finish out a day is just he'll fold the boxes, get them taped, I'll stuff them. And then the next morning we bring them over to the post office. And it's this tiny little post office right in Graniteville. And we just stand in line with everyone else and we ship out all of our boxes.
Far more than one a week or three a week.
It started out like a small little trickle, and now it's like, okay, hey, I'm pulling up with the car. We've got the trunk full. they're amazing.
So this far into it, about 6 months in, where do you go from here? What's next for Bergamot and Amour?
So, you know, we ask ourselves this question every day, and we're really just trying to stay fluid and stay on top of it. Peter has a son who just graduated from high school, so we're hoping that we can convince him to help us. And we've got a lot of scaling to do and to keep up, but we're growing rapidly, and we're just excited.
And all on social media, kind of word of mouth. You said 30 states you've shipped to and three countries. What are the three countries where people have finally caught on to you?
Yeah, we are in the U.S., we're in Canada, and we're in Romania.
Romania. Well, that must have been wild when you got that order.
It was very wild. But we are so, we're just lucky, and we're loving every moment of it.
And they had to figure out the postage over there at the
grid. We're so good. They knew what they were doing. I was so lucky.
All right. BergamotAmour.com is the website. You're also on Facebook, Instagram, so you should be able to find them. Amanda Marie Farrell, Peter Shangra, are co-owners of Bergamot and Amour in Williamstown. Again, the website is BergamotAmour.com. Amanda and Peter, thank you so much, and continued success for your company. It's great hearing all about it.
Thank you, Rick. It was wonderful.
Amanda Marie Farrell and Peter Shangra are the co-owners of Bergamot and Amour in Williamstown. Our focus this morning is on interesting Vermont businesses, and they didn't get much more interesting than when we visited Richard Bates, a master horologist at the British Clockmaker in Newfane.
Time in this biz is vitally important, and for me, any instrument that keeps time is an incredible contraption. How all those gears, springs, wheels, and or pendulums operate and then remain in perfect synchronization is bewildering. But not to some people. They have an amazing understanding of what all those moving parts do and how to keep them functioning precisely for years on end. And when they are out of alignment, they know how to make them operate perfectly again. Our next guest is that person. But we're not talking about adjusting a watch or most of the clocks that we tend to own. Our next guest is a specialist in the professional restoration of antique clocks, marine chronometers, and automata. And Richard Bates is a master horologist at the British Clockmaker in Newfane. Richard, thank you so much for being on the show this morning.
Oh, you're welcome. Thanks for having me.
It's great to have you. Richard, tell us about the work that the shop does.
We're primarily a restoration business, so we will repair clocks ranging anywhere in age from 300 or more years old to maybe 175 years old. So these are one-of-a-kind or two-of-a-kind clocks. We used to do watches. We don't restore watches anymore, but we do a wide array of clocks of all different shapes and sizes, like you mentioned in the beginning of the interview.
How did the British Clockmaker wind up in Newfane, Vermont?
Well, my father started the business back in 1957, and he established it in Edinburgh, Scotland. So his mother was a Scot, and his father was an Englishman. And so when he came to the U.S. and established the business here, he called himself the British Clockmaker.
When did you decide that you were going to make this your profession?
I will have been with this organization for 25 years. July 1st will be my 25th.
Wow.
Year. I think I always wanted to do it, so I'm told by my father, but I never knew it.
Right.
And he sort of plucked it out of me.
Yeah.
Taunted me with it. Put things in front of me, and eventually one thing led to the other. So.
No kidding. Did you do anything before you were doing clockmaking with him?
I was threatening to become a hairstylist at one point.
that's usually the two decisions that occur.
Not that that's a bad profession.
No, not at all.
I wanted to go into panic mode. At which point he offered me an apprenticeship to learn from him what he considered to be a much more professional avenue to go down.
Wow. So let's talk about that. What does it take to apprentice and then finally become what you are today, which is a master clockmaker?
Well, it's generally a five-year program that no longer really exists in America. There still is an organization in the UK called the British Horological Institute, and that's where he trained. So he set up an apprenticeship program based off of the training program that he started under. So it's a five-year intensive program that starts you from the very basics of understanding gears, understanding mechanics, physics, basically how the mechanism is able to run and function as a clock. And then once that understanding is sort of loosely understood, then a clock is dismantled and put back together again, hopefully without any remaining pieces on the bench.
Right.
And then eventually, with practice, like anything, lots of practice, one begins to understand how the two sides work. So you have this understanding of practicality and book information. And then you have this clock sitting on your bench that's 300 years old.
Yeah.
And there's a lot of wear. There's a lot of things in it that may have been altered by others in an attempt to repair them over the years.
Mm.
So we see a fair amount of really sort of not very nice work and some really nice work that's far and wide between. So there's a lot more of the not-so-nice work out there. And occasionally we see some very nice work done the way it should have been done.
Richard, I am so intrigued that you've got your oldest are about 300 years old. The new ones that you work on are 175 years old. I don't think there's a whole lot of parts in stock, you know, for a piece that wears out of a 250-year-old clock that there were only, you know, one or two made, right?
No, we have to be able to manufacture any of the parts that are broken, mangled, or missing. And so we have a complete machine shop, which allows us to manufacture any of the parts that we need. We can work with stock materials, which we can get from a variety of warehouse sort of businesses that supply us
yeah.
the stock material. But we have to be able to craft all those various stock metals into something usable, practical. And also in the making of the original maker, we try to reproduce any part we make in the style that it was made by the original maker, so it's very hard for anybody coming after us to locate that part.
This has got to be precise, painstaking work.
It is. I think I've lost a large portion of my hair due to the copious amounts of time and sometimes stress that goes into repairing some of these clocks.
Well,
stress in that it's sometimes confounding, and one has to
yeah.
step away from the bench in order to be able to solve it.
Well, speaking of hair, I mean, what is it that you enjoy about what you're doing now, and do you think you made the right choice between becoming a hairstylist and becoming a British clockmaker?
I do joke. I think I love this craft as much as I did when I first began it. It's been very exciting in the sort of basically trying to figure out how all these different pieces come together and make this ingenious device
mm-hmm.
work and work reliably. And in that, there's just this sort of thrill of discovery that never ends. That to me is sort of the magic. Taking something that's completely not working, maybe even hasn't worked for 40 or 50 years because everybody mm-hmm. said, oh, to the owner, this is not repairable. This is not fixable. This is something that just needs to sit on the shelf. And then it comes to us, and the challenge for us then, of course, is to say, well, no, we don't necessarily believe that's true yet. Let's see what we can do about it. And that's a lot of fun. That, to me, makes it fresh every day, every year, is that sort of moment.
To be outstanding at this, what are the skills and traits that one would need?
One needs a firm grasp of machining. One has to be able to manufacture from scratch a non-existing part and make it into an existing part, whether that be a gear, whether that be an arbor that supports the gear, whether that be a lever or some other function on the clock. So there has to be an understanding of mechanics so that you're not just manufacturing a part, but you understand precisely what that part was meant to do and when it was meant to come into play during its operation. And there's a firm understanding of chemistry because you have to be able to work with a variety of chemicals and you have to be able to work with tempering of steel, so you're heating steel up to harden it or soften it, depending upon what you want to do with it. And there's a large list, but I think that's a good core.
Yeah.
It's just looking at those aspects there.
It would seem that this is such a niche business that there can't possibly be enough business to sustain you. But how busy are you?
We are a flat year out solid on all of our new overhaul work. So if someone comes with a clock today that needs to be overhauled, they will see it approximately 1 year from today.
Wow. Who are your customers?
We're quite busy. Part of that, too, is my father laughs and jokes with me, and he says, well, I think I just outlived most of my competition, so that's why you're so busy right now. But I think it has a bit more to do with that. We've established a very strong reputation in New England, and we've been around a long time, since the 1950s.
Yeah. Who are your customers, and do they come from beyond Vermont?
We do. We have about a three-hour radius of the shop that customers will travel to us sort of comfortably. 3 hours is a long time to be in a car,
Yeah. Much
less to turn around and go back. But it does happen. Many people will ship us clocks as well. We have a large barn, which we can receive clocks in crates, and basically a four-and-a-half-hour radius of the shop. So traveling to a customer's home to assess the state of their clock, and then possibly bringing that clock back to the shop for further repair.
And once you're working on one, what's the average time? I know it's going to vary depending on what needs to be done.
It will vary.
Yeah.
It can be, generally speaking, it's anywhere from several weeks to several months from start to finish. So the clock will, a customer's clock will sit with us for a while until we're able to finally find the freedom and space to work on their clock. But the actual clock, once it is actually on the bench, from the time it hits the bench and then leaves the testing area, it can range anywhere from several weeks to, a couple months.
This is an encore edition of our interview with Richard Bates of New Fane, the British clockmaker, from June of this year.
Now, Richard, I know you came into the business when there was already emails and you could send pictures or videos of a clock of what they're doing or not doing. But your dad was in the business a long time without Internet. So how was he able to get a sense of what you needed to do with this clock?
Well, I think if he was taking a call and that day, he didn't have the emails, like you said, or the Internet. So he would take a cold call from a customer, and he would try to gather from them through questioning them what sort of issues the clock may or may not be having, and ask them a series of questions pertaining to maybe the clock's servicing history so that we could tell more about, what sort of shape the clock might be in. Basically, any clock, the mechanism is only, the oil is only good in the mechanism for about 5 years, and then it begins to turn into a thick paste, which can cause a lot of destruction over time. And so many times, that's the starting point. So one of the questions that he used to ask them and he trained me to ask was, well, when was the last time the clock was properly serviced? And if the answer is anywhere beyond 10 years or even 20 years or 30 years, then we pretty much know the state of the mechanism if it's been allowed to run in any sort of continual time during that span of time.
All right, let's get some calls in here. Rich is joining us first from Starksboro. Hi, Rich. Go right ahead.
Hi. I was wondering if you could provide a little general commentary on the market value of old clocks that don't work versus the market value of old clocks that do work.
Yeah, hi, Rich. The tricky thing about the market right now is there are many beautiful clocks out here, as well as many beautiful pieces of art, and the market for them as it has been and continues to be a sort of a flat line. So there's not a lot of value, physical value, and even a working, much less a non-working item. And a lot of that's attributable to just basically the tastes have changed. So you've got a lot of people that have these smartphones or these smart watches, mm-hmm. and it's debatable whether or not they make you smarter. But the biggest thing that happens there is people don't want to take the time to restore or work on or own an antique that requires attention, requires care. And that's really what's keeping the market down. I hope that helps you.
Let's go next to Craig in Bristol. Hi, Craig. Go right ahead.
Good morning. I just wonder if your guest repairs wooden works clocks. My late uncle had a Barnes clock from the Chimney Point area here in Vermont.
We do work on wooden works clocks, and they can be a temperamental thing, as you may or may not know already. I'm sure you know, probably. So they're subject to warping, twisting, sort of the usual things that wood can sort of go through. And so that's the biggest challenge with the wooden works clocks.
Good to know. I know my uncle had had one set of works set up with a plexi outside the clock with a plexiglass cover over it so you could see how the darn thing actually worked.
Oh, that's clever, sure.
Thank you very much.
All right,
You're
Craig,
welcome.
That you can reach Richard. Their website is thebritishclockmaker.com if you have more questions. Let's go to Cindy next. Hi, Cindy. Go right ahead.
Hi. Yeah, hi. Thanks for taking my call. This is probably, I don't know if he has any information about this, but I have always loved sundials, which tell time. And I grew up with one in Wisconsin. We had an old one on a pedestal, and I would just love to know if he knows if people even still make them or if they're still a possibility.
We have manufactured them various times during my time with my father, so we do have some available in our shop that could be dusted off, so to speak.
Well, let's talk about that. You use the word manufacturer. The name is the British Clockmakers, and a lot of what we've spoken about, Richard, so far is restoring these antique clocks. Do you actually make clocks?
We have. We don't do too much of it because it's rather a costly affair for the customer.
Mm-hmm.
But we have made probably a number of grandfather clocks primarily. We had a couple that we made for an artist, so he had cases that he made, and then he had specifications that he gave us for a mechanism that would work inside of those cases. So that was one example or two examples. So we do manufacture custom-made clocks, but we don't have a lot of time for that, unfortunately, these days, because most of our time is spent at the bench restoring the many clocks that we have in the shop to repair.
I do love hearing that your craftsmanship is still so revered and still in such demand. Now, you work on antique clocks. That I can understand. What is a marine chronometer?
So a marine chronometer, this is the ingenious device that was made at a time when ships were crossing the ocean, and they were having a hard time getting the ship from one port to the next without destroying it or crashing it, with all their cargo and their ship hands going to the bottom of the ocean. So they needed to have the ability to be able to take time at land and have a continual source of time at sea so they could have a comparison between the two.
Mm-hmm.
So a marine chronometer was designed and was invented primarily as a guide at sea to tell correct time off of the ultimate thing, which was longitude.
Wow. And then, I hope I pronounced it right, automata. What is that?
So automata is a fun thing. These are the early forms of entertainment. So dating back before jukeboxes or CD players or anything like this. So you'd have an example would be maybe a singing bird cage. So it looks just like a bird cage, and inside the cage, which is visible to the eye, is a bird, or maybe two birds, sitting on a little make-up tree or shrubbery. And then on the bottom of the mechanism is a key to wind the mechanism up, which fires up the mechanism. And what you see and hear is this bird chirping this beautiful bird song, but it's a mechanical device that's trapped and housed below him or her, and it's rather ingenious, and they take many different shapes and forms, and they're kind of fun. If you Google them, you'll find a real variety of different types of automata out there.
Richard, we have about a minute left, but on your website, you mentioned that you would rather not have people take a crack at trying to or have someone else try to take a crack at fixing these antique clocks. Why is that?
I think you really need to have a qualified professional that's trained with the knowledge and the skill set to be able to work on these one-of-a-kind or two-of-a-kind clocks. And I think there are a lot of people out there that are amateurs, and they don't really fully understand all the different avenues involved in bringing a clock back to life. And I think that's kind of where we're going with that statement.
Is there anyone training under you now who's apprenticing with you at the Blizzard?
I keep on praying that my 12-year-old daughter will not end up becoming a surgeon like she wants to become, instead of becoming a craftsman like her old daddy. But at this point, no.
Just tell her it's surgery on these beautiful old clocks. Richard Bates is a master.
I can always fix your hands. You
That's
know.
Right. Richard Bates is a master horologist at the British Clockmaker in Newfane. And again, you can learn more at thebritishclockmaker.com. Richard, thank you so much for taking time out to share some of the insight into your craft.
You're welcome, and thank you, Rick. I appreciate it.
That was Richard Bates, the British Clockmaker in Newfane, on this encore edition of Vermont Viewpoint. That is our show for today. Vermont Viewpoint is directed by Danny McGivrigan, and feel free to suggest guests or topics or a place you think we should broadcast from during WDEV's 90th anniversary. You can email us, vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com. You can listen to past episodes of Vermont Viewpoint by downloading our podcast at wdevradio.com. The podcast is sponsored by The Warren Store, funky, friendly, and almost world famous. I'm Rick Sengary. Tomorrow we'll hear the best of our beer and spirits interviews as we continue our best of week on Vermont Viewpoint.